This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you, Sabrina, for the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Ivaraj
and Christine Wong.
A little bit later on, we'll also be joined by Jeff Sandhu. He's got a story about flood mitigation here in KL and a few other places around the country. Before we do that, though, our stories for today will be revolving around the first two are actually about Facebook, how they are the bad guy and the good guy all at the same time.
I wouldn't say good guy, not yet.
Oh, yeah, all right, so then.
It's a 50-50 kind of
50-50 kind of stuff. Okay, then we have Jeff's story. He'll be joining us about it's all about flood mitigation, like I've just said. And then story four will be about fruit flies and algorithms.
Yep.
Lots of F's today.
Yeah, we're just doing an alliteration Friday right now.
We are. And then finishing off, of course, with some podcast recommendations for stuff that you might want to listen to over the weekend. Right. If you want to get in touch, you can get us at BFM Radio on Twitter or on WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Right. Off we go then. So this news that I read the other day. Do we know who Sean Parker is?
Vaguely, but do explain.
Okay, so Sean Parker originally was the guy who created Napster. You might remember that. Some of you might remember that.
Let's call him Justin Timberlake.
Yeah,
from,
yeah. I was about to say the social network.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so him. He was also Facebook's first president way back in 2004, I believe it was. He did an interview recently, and he said that he kind of had this really disturbing warning, and it's stuff that we've spoken about before about Facebook's social media network. He said, and I quote, "God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains." Right? Not just children's brains, let it be said. So he spoke to this website called Axios, and he talked openly about what he perceives as the dangers of social media and how it exploits human vulnerability. Right? This is kind of stuff we've spoken about, but he, being the ex-president of Facebook, goes real into depth of it. And this is a quote from him. He said, "The thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them, was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? That means that we need to give you some sort of a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever, and that's going to get you to contribute more content, and that's going to get you more likes and comments. It's a social validation feedback loop. Exactly the kind of thing that a hacker would come up with because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology." It's people like Mark Zuckerberg, it's himself, it's Kevin Systrom of Instagram. All of these people understood this mechanism and consciously did it anyway. There's been questions pointed to Facebook about whether or not they want to respond to these comments. They've decided no, they don't want to talk about it right now, surprisingly enough. Now, one of the things that he also goes on to talk about and is kind of explored in this article is about the idea of making an app into a kind of slot machine kind of feel. So if you look at a bunch of your apps on your phone, for example, Facebook being one of them, Twitter being another one, Instagram also have joined this club. There is a little thing where you can pull down to refresh, right? And that is the idea of a slot machine. They've based the idea of a slot machine. It gives you that little dopamine rush when you pull down on it and you think, bing, I have a new notification, or there's a new piece of something. That's literally tapping into this dopamine mechanism, hoping that you're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it. The very fact that these guys knew exactly what they were doing, this is why we've seen so many psychologists join the Facebook crew, why we've seen so many psychiatrists involved with all this kind of stuff. These are people who are literally socially engineering us and users to spend as much time as possible on these social media apps, and we've discussed how dangerous social media can be if you don't move away from it, right?
And if you don't have control.
And if you don't have control.
Yeah. So even when you want to exit the Facebook app, I don't know if it's the same on the iPhone, but if you try to do it on like my phone, when I try to hit the back key, it'll just reload the whole timeline again.
Wow.
It'll go back to the top, and then it's like fully all new stories that I haven't seen the last time I scrolled for the last half an hour.
Yeah.
So you do that, and then on Instagram, of course, you can do the drag down, and then it does the refresh thing. So they kind of make you want, if you want to exit, if you're done with your 15 minutes or whatever you're scrolling, you've seen everything, you want to exit, then they want to keep you there by showing showing you stories that you didn't see the first time around.
It's the same on the iOS app. You can come out of the app, and when you go back, instead of it picking up from where you've left off, it goes back to the very top again. You have to scroll all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Even like the 9GAG mobile app, the moment you scroll anywhere, it's like, hey, see new posts. Hey, see new posts. And it keeps prompting you to refresh so that you stay on there forever.
Right. Irritating, right?
Very.
But also effective.
Yeah.
Because it keeps you there. And that's their whole purpose. It's they want to keep you there. Yeah. Then you watch videos again and then they get to show you their ads and all that
stuff.
Correct. So very, like, super effective.
Yeah.
Annoying if you've already spent like 45 minutes watching like useless videos and stuff and just spending your time. So
right.
It depends.
The other thing as well, I mean, we're not stupid, you know, and we realize that a lot of thought goes into the creation of the user interface, the UI, right? The colors that they've chosen, the specific colors, the specific red that they've chosen, has that effect on our brain as, ooh, shiny, I need to find out what that is. You know, Apple have very effectively used that technique. Mm-hmm. The very fact that when you get a new notification, it doesn't just pop up. It almost slowly appears, you know, like a flower kind of blooming in slow motion. You're like, this is so pretty. What is this? Bing, you click it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when you realize that we are being manipulated on that level, you know, and it's so deeply ingrained into us now. Mm-hmm. And people like you, Christine, who's grown up, you know, entirely in this age of the internet, you know, this is what worries me for people of subsequent generations, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is one of those reasons why on some of the apps that I have, I've disabled that like little red badge.
Yeah.
Right? Because it kind of instills this need in you to keep checking and keep checking and keep checking and keep refreshing because something might be happening. You don't know what.
Right.
It might not even be relevant to you. It might not be content that is actually... Because I've noticed that there are some apps that will just notify you about stuff that like you did not want to be notified
about.
Correct. So it will just say something like, something really generic like, hey, a thing is happening. And you're like, I didn't ask for you to tell me that the thing is happening, but now that I know a thing is happening, gotta check it.
I better check it out. I mean, I know Matt Armitage in particular has, you know, I dread to think how many unread emails he has, but his badge is ridiculous. You know, it's something like 9,999 unread emails. For me, that makes me feel uncomfortable seeing that number, even just seeing one.
Same here.
You know, and I'm like, I have to check it. And then I think to myself, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, why are you falling into this trap?
But I mean, have you seen your comments where there's the new, the congratulations thing where you hit it and then there's the balloons and it just pops up?
Oh, my word.
Do you hit on one or do you hit on like a few comments at the same time?
Just the one.
Just the one.
Oh, you're doing the multiple ones.
Yeah, because it, even though it's the same thing, you have the tendency of like you hit one and then you're like, oh, and then you hit the next one and then you hit the third one down. Even though it's exactly the same
thing, nothing changes.
You
are the cat chasing the red laser light.
Yeah. That's what and they know because it's in that color. It's in that nice orange.
Yeah.
And then it's the nice animation that pops up. It's there's something about that.
It's so smooth. It's 2D and it looks very pretty.
Yeah. Like. Even though it's a cartoon and it's the same thing every single time.
All right. So that's the kind of deep and dirty Facebook monster that we've kind of that Sean Parker has told us he has helped unleash onto the world. But then in a related story, we have this one where. I don't even know if I can say this with a straight face after saying that story. You know, Facebook will teach the unemployed digital social media skills in 30 cities.
Yeah.
So, I mean... Yeah.
So they're launching this thing called Community Boost.
Okay.
And what this is, they want to go to 30 cities in the US and they want to teach the unemployed digital and social media skills because they found out that in small companies, in small enterprises, knowing Facebook and social media is more important than knowing where the person went to school.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's the question now. If they think that you know how to use social media, if you are digitally savvy, there's a higher chance for you to get employed in smaller companies, in 60% of smaller companies. And they're not even interested in asking these people where they studied, what their backgrounds are and all that kind of stuff.
This sounds like one of those things where these companies have realized that they have an aging workforce and they need young tech-savvy kids to come in and bail them out.
Yeah, so that's what Facebook has found out about these companies, and then they want to go and teach them social media skills. But now there's the 50-50 I mentioned before is because people are saying that Facebook is only going to teach these people about Facebook. So they're going to pick these people who are unemployed, and then they're going to go, and then they're going to team up with these small enterprises, and then they will teach these people how to do Facebook marketing and how to build a social media network revolving around Facebook. So they're saying that it's not completely without agenda. They are still trying to push their Facebook marketing stuff. But it also says that the other 50% of it, it says that it still empowers people who don't know how to use social media to use social media, because Facebook still is the biggest social media network.
But I mean, is this going to be involved with the whole Facebook ecosystem, stuff like Instagram as well, or just
Facebook?
Just Facebook.
Just Facebook. For now, just Facebook. The other thing is, there's a weird pattern how Facebook chooses these cities. So they say that the skills revolve around Facebook, and then it says that Facebook is the key to a better life in your working life.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But the stops on their tour include cities in all the red states. All the states that voted for Trump in 2016.
Or only?
Only. So all 30 cities are all red states. And they say that maybe Facebook hopes to reduce unemployment that led to the dissatisfaction with the political systems which landed with Trump being elected in the first place.
That is interesting.
Yeah. Or maybe they're going there to educate people in these states about things like fake news and things that they are unhappy with by introducing Facebook and how they curb things like this. And that's why they're focusing on red states first instead of blue states. There's no news of blue states yet.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a weird pattern that people have picked up. And they're not sure why Facebook has only targeted these cities.
Christine, I noticed your dad has tweeted. Oh. You know, Kenny Wong, I'm one of those who can't stand to see the iconic red buttons on the upper right side of my apps. I know all about that, Kenny. I feel you, man.
Thanks, Dad.
There you go. You were about to say, Christine, go on.
No, I mean, this is one of those things where I kind of have a bit of a weird feeling about this, because first of all, social media skills, like in and of itself, that term makes me very uncomfortable, because the thing is that Facebook can be used for a lot of different, ideas and different uses, but I don't know what skills are going to teach these people. Do you know what I mean? Like how to write a post, or like how a hashtag works, or like what exactly are they trying to, you know, what's the lesson plan is kind of my question here.
The lesson plan, they're saying that, you know, like one of their pitches in their outline, it says that if you're an entrepreneur, we will have training programs on how to use technology to turn an idea into a business, or show you ways to create a free online presence using Facebook. That's like the gist of it.
Mm.
But this is my question. You can just go on Facebook and then click like pages, and it will tell you step by step how to create your own page.
We know that.
Like that.
We know that. But there are people who are not so much older than me, including people in this office, that wouldn't have the first clue how to do that, even though it's, you know, instructed for you on screen.
Okay.
They have that techno fear, you know, if I click this, will I break the internet kind of thing.
See, then in that sense, then, you know,
and that's
I
why
do,
it makes sense for them to go to red states.
In that sense, then I do think that it is positive, just because it is a good way to be able to reach out to, like, your potential demographic for any businesses and things like that, like, especially if you're an entrepreneur and you don't know how to spread the word about the thing that you're interested in doing. So in that sense, I'm kind of for it. But the other thing about Facebook and targeting red states and things like that is that what I have found with Facebook is that you often, using social media, surround yourself with people who all think the same as you. You end up in a bit of a social media bubble, and it becomes not a place where you can, indulge in constructive arguments or discussion or ideas that are not your own. You end up kind of creating a reflection of your own political views and
echo
ideas.
Chamber.
And, yeah, an echo chamber. So I don't really know how Facebook is going to convince people who are very convinced of their own kind of ideas already to not just repeat those ideas to themselves over and over again in an echo chamber. How are they going to be able to, you know, regulate that, I suppose?
I don't know. They don't say. That's why it's a bit vague what they're planning to teach these people. They say that they want to have partnerships with, like, tech training schools for adults and, like, coding boot camps and stuff. And these things have nothing to do with Facebook. It's just to make them, like, digitally savvy. But on the other side, they say the sentiment is that there's a lot of unemployment in the red states, and Facebook has partnerships with small businesses who need you to know how to use Facebook. So they're training people to have those skills so that they can get absorbed into, like, small businesses. I think that's the logic of this, what Facebook is trying to do.
All right, we've had a good chat. We've spoken longer than we normally should have done, but that's because, you know, it's a passionate topic. It's stuff that we're all involved in. If you've got an opinion at home, like Kenny Wong, and you want to contribute, do get us on Twitter. We are at BFM Radio, or, of course, on WhatsApp on 018-789-8899. When we come back, something that's a little bit closer to home, we'll be talking about flood mitigation here in Malaysia with Jeff Sandu. He'll be joining us in just a couple of minutes. Up next, though, It Came Out of the Sky from CCR on BFM 89.9.
Break from midfield. BFM 89.9.
89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury, joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Christine Wong.
We've now been joined by Mr. Jeff Sandu.
Hello. But
before we get to Jeff, can I just say, you savages out there who are sending me messages with 21,000 unread emails making me feel so uncomfortable right now.
Matt Armitage, I think he has 60,000 unread emails, and he's trying to go for the 100,000
Can I just say as a PSA that if that badge is not a circle and has become an oblong, stop and clear your emails, please.
Can we just wrestle that phone out of his hands and just, like, you know, anyway.
Some experiment that he's doing.
Can you tell us that you wanted to do this story today?
Yeah, well, the reason why I was really adamant in doing this, because in Penang, the floods in Penang over the weekend was devastating, and you know, unfortunately, you know, I was there as well, and, you know, this is the first time I've witnessed floods to this degree, and if I'm not mistaken, it's also one of the worst Penang has ever seen, at least in the past decade or so, right? There were so many businesses that was affected, and this is coming from a personal experience when one of my friends, his car became a submarine for, like, you know, 6 hours, and we couldn't get any tow truck services on the next day when, you know, the water has, you know, subsided, but none of the tow truck services was able to actually come out and help us because they had problems with either their house getting flooded or their shops, their workshops, you know, it's completely just submerged in water. So, you know, it was a really difficult situation, and everyone there was trying to help each other people out, and it was just nice to see people helping, but, you know, it was a devastating thing. Even paddy farmers were nearly 5,500 paddy farmers out of 6,000 farmers were affected, according to this report by the Penang Integrated Agricultural Development Area. But the thing is, though, flood isn't something new. It isn't something that we discovered over the weekend. And natural disasters, it isn't something that we just suddenly, oh, wow, this natural disaster thing, we should do a story about this. It's been around for every year for the past...
Every single year.
I think since I was born, every year in... we will have stories about areas getting, you know, floods or, you know, being destroyed by some natural disaster. So what can we do is that question that we need to ask ourselves, right? So this is where technology can come into play, and it will help to reduce the pain when these kind of disasters arrive. So I got on the phone with Chris Lee. He's the country manager for Autodesk Malaysia. Autodesk Malaysia is obviously the guys who build a whole bunch of different softwares, and a lot of them are based on simulating on what, you know, things would look like in the real world, whether it's construction, industrial, electrical, pipings, all those kind of things. It all goes through AutoCAD. They are the guys who make this software. So I asked him, like, you know, just, hey, Chris, like, what is some of the tech that's actually available right now for a place like Penang?
First and foremost, I think the weather itself have a very different volume of size of waters coming down. So technology does have the ability to track. But given the analytics need a lot of data sources, first and foremost, cities like Penang or any other cities that is actually subjected to natural changes have to look into analytics such as IoT advanced analytics, using sensors to collect design data which they can actually predict the volume of waters that can be handled by canals, by underground drainage systems, and through those, they can actually do more preventive maintenance and allowing the environment to take a prediction of how much water can it handle as a city. But more importantly, as we use more and more IoT sensors, you realize that the cost of our sensors is also coming down. And that provides the economy of scale for cities to actually really explore the possibility of implementing a lot of smart sensors. And this may also be used as of today in traffic management, in infrastructure modeling, as well as human behavior tracking, such as the temperature in the building, etc., and allowing building to be more sustainable, indirectly contributing to greener buildings and helping the environment to cope with the different changes that is taking place.
like he mentioned at the beginning, climate change is real, because the water that we are seeing now, that's the downpours that we are seeing now, is unlike anything we've seen before. So climate change is real. We just got to do something about it. And in sensors, he talked about, you know, putting sensors in so that you have preventive measures in place to know where are some of the areas that could be more at risk, or just get alerts when it hits a certain amount. It's just like your phone. You have a data warning. You can set it to, like, if I have a 10 gig plan, you know, give me a warning when I hit 8 gig. The same thing applies to drainage system, jams, floods, water management, whatever it is. It's just putting sensors, and they're cheap now. So then I asked him about drones, because, you know, I know there are a lot of usage of drones when it comes to natural disasters like earthquakes and stuff, but is there anything for floods? And this is what he had to say about drones.
Drone itself, it doesn't really give much information, but the high definition surveying capability of the drone is allowing us as designers or engineers to really capture a lot of information about environment, from geographical landscape such as a terrain to buildings, locations, roads, infrastructure. In the point of inside the building, we can capture those information and present it in a very intelligent modeling that allow us to do a lot of engineering analytics. So case in point, in Singapore itself, some of the tunnels today are actually being inspected using drones. And this drone is actually programmed to fly in the automated schedule and allowing engineers to capture those data. So a lot of automations and high definition surveying equipments, and integrating with AR, augmented reality, and VR, engineers can actually do a lot of pre-maintenance schedule to the point whereby they do not actually have to expose themselves to a lot of environmental risks.
And then, of course, there's flood simulation softwares as well. And, you know, Autodesk are obviously players in this area where, you know, they've got software solutions for infrastructure simulation or even flood simulation as well. And simulation is really a key here. You can simulate what happened in the real world once you sort of map out the entire area using those drones that he was talking about. You have, like, the elevation of the land itself, the drainage system that you probably have the blueprint, the amount of water that flows through the river, etc., etc. And then you can sort of simulate what would happen if you have X amount of downpour and within a quick space of time, and, you know, how you sort of, which are the areas that is more, you know, risk adverse than others. So from then on, you can sort of focus in on what you need to build and how you need to go about it. And you know what, when you look at it, it's basically just building a smarter city.
Yeah.
You know, something that I've been talking about this for a long time, Singapore, you know, as Chris mentioned, you know, they are gunning for this whole smart nation. And here in Selangor, we've got, you know, the Smart Selangor initiative. And it's all just about, you know, building that smart city. So I asked Chris, is it really just having the mindset of building a smart city? And also, what actually needs to happen to make this into a reality, especially for Penang?
Every city is trying to be smarter, and different definition and different guidelines is being drawn up by governments as well as agencies. But what is important is for cities to recognize that you can't transform the landscape overnight. So using existing data that you can model, right, like the heritage centers that you can't really remove, but having those incorporated and create an intelligent model of the whole landscape and allowing city planners to decide what they can change and what they cannot change. That's a very important step. And having the flood modeling or analytics helping them to plan ahead of their changes without having to change and then realize that those changes doesn't really help. So in Autodesk, I think the design itself is the core belief in what we provide as a technology. But on top of that, the city planner, as they fabricate, as they make the changes, they can actually predict those impact in the digital platform or in the digital world before they actually go into the physical implementation. I would think the changes that you see today are actually a multitude of various decisions that's been made. So technology can help, but it's actually only one of the main critical factor. So policies and support from the local administrator will make a huge impact to the future, you know, way of mitigation of any of this form of calamity.
Yeah, and Chris also mentioned that technology is basically an enabler. It's always an enabler. Engineers, developers these days, they're all empowered with technology like these to just make the world a better place. And the cost of technology these days, especially in the software space, it's just a lot more affordable. It's no more expensive anymore. And he also mentioned that, you know, previously a lot of public sector, they want to own the piece of software. But right now, the reason why it's cheaper is because you don't actually have to own it. You could actually just, still have the software in place, acquire it, be able to learn how to actually use it and operate this technology without ever worrying about, owning it and how to sort of protect it and update it, right? So you don't need to have a whole team. And also, I'd just like to say, we all here at BFM, because we do know we have listeners from Penang who listen to us via our app. So we just want to wish, everyone who has been affected in the Penang floods to just keep your chin up and, just stay strong, because it is tough times. A lot of businesses were struggling to sort of get their feet back up again after what's happened. But it's just keep your chin up. It's one of those good stories to have later on in the future. And if you have a really cool story, just drop us an email, enterprise@bfm.my. We'll be more than happy to listen to some of your stories. Also, it's nice to see companies like Grab and Uber to come out. They've also shown their support. Perodua and Honda, they're offering help to assist those cars who have been affected by the floods. Samsung Malaysia came out and announced their flood relief campaign for mobile devices and also other electronic goods for those in Penang. So you can find out a whole bunch of other companies are sort of jumping into this and trying to help out.
Right.
And it's just really good to see. But yeah, keep your chin up, Penangites, and technology. Look at technology. It's seriously, we talk about how it's going to endanger the future and our lives are dictated by social media and all that kind of things. But there's actually such a huge positive on technology that we sometimes don't see it, because it's just embedded within the whole entire system itself. And it will be great if you could go up to speak to your local council and push them to, hey, since you are going to now, do reports on what we can do to sort of help Penang in the future for, not have something like this happen again, or at least, reduce the risk, get them to, understand that technology is there, and hopefully, they'll be able to reach out to the experts in this field, whoever they are, as long as, you just invest rightly and, get technologies that could help you, because it's not something new. Again, floods, it's been there for forever, right? But technology, it has now caught up and it's now cheaper. So let's do this. And if we could do it, if we could make Penang a smart city, wow. It'll be something to be really proud of around the world.
Yeah.
There's always, a light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully technology is that train that drives us to the light, right?
So, thanks, Jeff. Okay, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking about what you can learn from fruit flies and how they can improve our search algorithms. One more thing to add to that, Jeff. I mean, there's one thing when I read about floodings here in Malaysia, whether it be in Penang or whether it be in the Klang Valley or wherever it is, there's a whole bunch of things, that really run through my mind and really resonate as we see, first and foremost, the amount of litter that we see, blocking up drains and one thing or another. That is something that really needs to be addressed in this country. Stop throwing rubbish out of your car. Put it in a bin, for heaven's sake. That's the first thing. Yeah. And we're cutting down trees in areas which need to be there for drainage. We're not helping ourselves, guys. These are just a couple of things that we can do to make a start.
Don't for once think that, once we have technology, bang, yeah, problem solved. I can go back to doing my things. Don't do that. You have a role to play here too. Don't throw your rubbish out of the car. I just witnessed one yesterday. A guy just threw out his McDonald's package right out of his car window at the traffic light, and I was like, dude.
Right. See? Right. Short break. If you want to join the conversation, you can get us at BFM Radio on Twitter. This is REM with Radio Free Europe. Thanks, Jeff, here on Enterprise BizBytes.
Better Finance Management. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. It's our final story of the day before we move on to podcast suggestions. Christine has brought to the table a story about what we can learn from fruit fly brains to improve our search algorithms.
The first thing I learned is that fruit flies have brains. That's the one thing I picked up.
Well, yes. So first of all, yes, fruit flies do have brains. Thank you very much, Arvind. But okay, before I kind of go into how the fruit fly thing works, computers are always doing searches that involve comparing similar things.
Right.
As you know, Facebook has a people you may know thing. YouTube will have a list of suggested things in the corner saying, hey, because you liked this, you'll like this. So fruit flies actually do a similar thing in order to survive.
They do?
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Rich, for the sarcasm.
That's the story.
But so what it is, so if fruit flies learn that, like, say, for example, the smell of an orange indicates food, they'll know in the future that a similar smell is also food that they can eat.
Right.
And in a study that was published in the journal Science, because that's just a science journal that's called Science, apparently, scientists found that the way their brains do this is different from how most computer algorithms do it, and by using the fly method, we could potentially make our computer programs better. So, the way that currently computers do this is, imagine your computer is comparing, let's say, Coldplay and Radiohead. There are a lot of attributes to look at: genre, speed, gender of the singer, instruments. A computer takes all of these attributes and then boils it down to like 10 attributes, which is a more manageable number. And they then assign a tag called a hash to each of these items. When it does a similarity search, it compares the hashes instead of going through all of the specific attributes.
Right.
Now, flies actually do the opposite of this. When fruit flies smell something for the first time, 15 neurons fire in a unique combination. But instead of simplifying these neurons to 10, the way a computer would do it, they expand this information, and the fly brains send the information throughout the brain to 2,000 neurons. So why would this make them faster at identifying similar smells? Let's say, for example, you have like 50 people, and you want to find the similarities between them. If you put them in a small room, they're going to be crowded in on each other and it'll be really hard to organize them. But if you take the 50 people and you spread them out in a big field, it's easier to identify information. So spreading the information around helps the fly brain give a more unique label to each smell. Then it stores the top 5% of these 2,000 neurons as quote-unquote hashes. So instead of narrowing down the number of attributes that you kind of filter things through, you actually expand that to a lot more and get more detail, and therefore the computer algorithms will hopefully be able to get, better and more refined searches from here.
Wow.
So fruit flies.
I'm like, hang on a minute.
And science.
Fruit flies who have a lifespan of what, 3 days?
Yeah. But apparently, this is the stuff that goes through their brains.
This is quite amazing.
Firing into like 2,000 neurons and stuff. No, but that is so cool.
Yeah.
Because it picks up a bit of information and then it just spreads it out to like the rest of its brain. And
I also wasn't
sector.
Aware that fruit flies had 2,000 neurons to think with, but apparently they do.
Yeah.
And they can process that amount of information and expand that amount of information in such a short time and then use that to live their lives for however long that they live their lives.
But I mean, you know, thinking about it, wouldn't this complicate the way in which we search for things then? I mean, if you're kind of expanding on that level, whether or not it's 2,000 neurons or 2,000 extra searches or 2,000 hashes or whatever it is, you're increasing the size of that database search, right? So therefore, we have to look at storage and one thing or another. Wouldn't this make things a little bit more, although more accurate, wouldn't it make it larger and slower perhaps?
The thing is, I think with this is that they're trying to figure out, first of all, about how accurate the methods are before they think about processing power or data storage or anything like that. These scientists tested this expansion approach already on 3 data sets, and they kept the computing power exactly the same. So the processing power, the storage, everything. And they just judged only on how accurate the old versus new methods are. And they found that the fly method is actually 30 to 50% more accurate than any other search method that they found so far.
That's very interesting.
So the thing is with this is that, again, with the, you know, with the kind of caveats of, we don't know how long it might take to refine search engines in this way. But the fact of the matter is they found an algorithm that works better than the one we do now.
And the other curious thing for me is, you know, how do they know how a fruit fly thinks?
I actually have no clue. There's not a lot of information here about how exactly they've managed to get this information out of fruit fly brains, but they have.
Right.
I don't really want to ask co-authors Saket Navlaka about, you know, how long did you spend around fruit flies to get this information, but they have, and it's incredible.
It is very interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I love this stuff because it's always the same. Like, we always look at some animals animal, and then we take what they do, and then we implement it into our daily lives. It's like bats. I think we use a sonar for like submarines, and then
dolphins as well.
And dolphins as well. And then there was what other animal? There's like a bunch of animals that we look at, like even birds, and they're hollow bones and stuff. And we use it for aerodynamics and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know who studied the fruit fly, and these are not like normal flies. These are like the ones that are like 10 times smaller. Yeah. You hardly see them. So
I'm waiting for the day then which we can pick up stuff from salamanders and geckos, and we can walk up walls, and when bits of your body fall off, they grow back.
Isn't that the geckos are those gloves?
They're the gloves,
the one
yeah.
that was
yeah.
used in Mission Impossible 3.
Correct.
The one
yeah.
Tom Cruise used to scale yeah. the buildings
I mean,
and stuff.
Even yeah. plants have given rise to Velcro. That's how that works.
That's
it's
true.
How seeds hook on your clothes and stuff.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's
yeah.
how Velcro works.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's where they got it from.
Speaking of Velcro, one of the funniest GIFs I've ever seen is a cat licking Velcro. Can
Amazing.
I just say that out loud?
Fantastic.
All right, it's time to take a short break. We've got some music coming up from The Clash. It's 1-2, Crush on You. When we come back, we'll be giving you some suggestions for podcasts you should be listening to over the weekend from Enterprise BizBytes. This is BFM 89.9.
Barry fronts Motown. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes, ladies and gentlemen. It is pretty much time for us to wrap up, but we've got some suggestions of stuff that maybe you'd like to listen to over the weekend. We're going to give you those now. A couple of podcasts, funnily enough, both by the same person. Majida Hashim, of course, has done some stuff this weekend, and it starts off with this podcast called Braving the Terrible Lows. So in an infamous tweet exchange that went viral in July of this year, Eric Diepenveen, the CEO of a Dutch games company, described Elon Musk's life on Instagram as amazing. And goes on to ask the Tesla and SpaceX mastermind if the ups and downs he had makes for an enjoyable life. Elon Musk responded to the tweet saying, and I quote, "The reality is great highs, terrible lows, and unrelenting stress. Don't think people want to hear about the last two." Unquote. The truth is, most startup founders pay a high price behind the incredible highs that comes with entrepreneurship, and this often takes a toll on the psyche of the founder themselves. Majida spoke to a clinical psychologist, Dr. Joel Lowe, from the Mind Psychological Services and Training, about how startup founders can brave the terrible lows of entrepreneurship. That one, again, is called Braving the Terrible Lows.
And Majida did another podcast to listen to as well, called Lessons from the Co-Founder of Starbucks. Now, if you guys don't already know, on the 31st of March 1971, history teacher Zeph Siegel and his two friends Jerry Baldwin and Gordon Bowker opened the very first Starbucks store in Seattle, Washington. Back then, Starbucks sold only whole roasted coffee beans and did not brew coffee to sell yet. Fast forward 46 years and Starbucks now has over 27,000 stores in 70 countries. And on that particular podcast, Zeph Siegel speaks fondly about how he set up his coffee and empire and what entrepreneurs can learn from his decades of startup experience.
Some really interesting stuff in that podcast, actually. Right, we'll run through the stories that we covered today, just in case you missed any of this show. And if you did, you can listen back to the show a little bit later on, of course, on our app, which is available in the App Store or on Google Play. Or if you're still old school, you can head over to the website, bfm.my/podcast, and listen there. I started off with a story about the Facebook monster that we have created, the social media beast. Then Arvin came and went.
How they're teaching 30 cities in the US how to be social media and digitally savvy.
Jeff Sandu then joined us in the studio and talked about some of the tech that's involved in potential flood mitigation that we could be using and looking at in the future. And then
I talked about how scientists are learning from fruit fly. Brains, sorry, to improve our search algorithms, and I need to improve my enunciation.
Say that three times.
Fruit Fry Fridays is what we're talking about, right?
Yes.
So that's what we've had for you today, but don't go anywhere, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is a Breakfast Grill replay.
Mm-hmm. And Paul Gibbons, he is the managing director of Sports Direct Malaysia. He was on the show this morning. Sports Direct Malaysia, it is the local imprint of the UK retail giant, and it recently opened its 28th store in Kuala Lumpur, with two more in the pipeline for 2018. So they asked the question of whether this will wither the company's fortunes in the present retail landscape. The grill spoke to Paul Gibbons about the company's growth plans in Malaysia and its strategy in dealing with the challenging retail climate.
There you go, folks. That's all we have time for right now. But do have yourselves a lovely weekend. We will be back, of course, on Monday. Same time, same place at noon on Enterprise BizBytes. On behalf of Arvind Uvaraj and Christine Wong, my name is Rich Bradbury. This is BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.